paper.
Welcome to episode 119 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Susan Warner Keane, a Toronto-based artist working in handmade paper who has been exhibiting in Canada and internationally since 1980. Keane graduated from the Ontario College of Art, where she specialized in weaving and felt making, subsequently shifting her practice to focus on paper making by 1990. The acquisition of Arena Beater enabled her to set up her studio to develop artworks that are created during the paper making process itself, exploring ways to make objects with an internal architecture created by the material conditions. Her ongoing interest in the intersection of ideas and materiality is reflected in her exploration of aspects of language, the book form, and the nature of the page. In addition to her gallery exhibitions and commission work, she has worked as an editor at the Ontario Crafts Council, written catalog essays, curated exhibitions, and taught numerous workshops, as well as teaching part-time at Sheridan College School of Craft and Design from 1993 to 2005. Her work has been supported by peer-reviewed grants from the Ontario Arts Council and the Canada Council for the Arts, and it can be found in several Canadian public collections. Well, Susan Warner Keane, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. It's lovely to see you, Helen.
Yeah, it's been a long time. And we're seeing each other on Zoom, not in person. Anyways, tell me a little bit about where you grew up and any creative influences in childhood.
Well, I'm Canadian. I grew up in Eastern Canada, in Ottawa, the Ottawa area.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't think I had any extraordinary creative influences. Going to look at things in museums and galleries, you know, as you know, people who have access to those things, you know, have normally done. I had a rather academic background. And so, you know, I had some extra art classes that I always enjoyed. But because I was fairly strong academically, I tended to get sort of streamed that way. So, you know, Latin and, you know, every year in high school didn't leave a lot of time for other things. It was really, I think when I started to travel around a little bit more and see, I actually was in New Mexico for a while, and I started seeing things, well, like the amazing ceramics. I knew people at the San Ildefonso Pueblo and potters, and it was the first, and weavings, of course, the Navajo weavings. And it was the first time I had really been struck at how powerful these objects were and how connected they were to storytelling. And my interest was literature, and I studied English literature initially at university. And so I was interested in this whole narrative thing, but it just, and I guess it came late to me, that these objects had this potential. So I think that was kind of the first little niggling thing, but it wasn't.
And what took you to New Mexico? Was that,
well, I had this gets a little complicated, but I had an opportunity to pass through Santa Fe briefly, traveling towards California, and I thought, wow, this is a really interesting place. And so when I was I think it was in my last year university, I organized some time, spending some time there with a friend who was doing some research on the Tewa worldview. And so we spent some time there, and it was fabulous. And I have to say that I was highly tempted to stay. Now I was Canadian, so that was a problem. I didn't have residency, so I had to leave. But so I think that was important. And then, but when I graduated and I had jobs in publishing, I was publishing related jobs for several years. But you know, it was the 70s, and we were all thinking about expanding consciousness and thinking about, you know, how to be in the world. And I started reading Joseph Campbell, and I was very interested in anthropology. I almost decided to do a master's in anthropology at one point. So I think in the course of that, I just realized how my background had been somewhat narrow, because so academic, and that, well, I really ought to work on other aspects of the brain. And so I started working with my hands. I started embroidering, and ultimately, I'm going to abbreviate this, led me to go to art school at 26. So I was a bit of a late starter, and I only intended to go for a year because I was wrestling with color, and I thought, you know, other people have probably worked on this problem before. There's probably some, you know, principles involved here. And sure enough, it turned out there was color theory. So anyway, so I ended up 4 years at art school.
Okay, so you were wrestling with color. What medium were you working in?
I learned to weave.
Oh, weaving. Okay.
Yeah. I started weaving. And of course, the interaction of color, the visual optical mixing of color is very important with weaving.
Right.
So then I attended the Ontario College of Art, and which is now called OCED University.
Okay.
To study textiles. Yeah.
Okay.
That was kind of when I kind of really got, because I was only going to go for, you know, just the basics. And then I realized how much I really didn't know. And, you know, 4 years later. Yeah.
Right.
So.
Oh, wow. So did you explore all kinds of textiles, or did you?
Well, I was focused on weaving. Mm-hmm. But of course, while I was there, I had I saw this amazing exhibition at the Royal Ontario Museum of traditional felt making. And this was in the mid 70s. And Veronica Jervers, who was an associate curator there, was one of the people who was really documenting this amazing, it kind of exploded onto onto the textile scene anyway. And there were a number of really important books published at the time. And I think, I mean, the objects themselves were amazing, but the photographs of how this material was actually made was galvanizing. And wow, so this is a constructed textile, but it's not, you know, loom dependent. It's not grid based. It's this material, this fiber that's just, you know, made into this. So I got quite fascinated and immediately dived into felt making, and it did sort of shift my whole perspective. And of course, as we know, it's not a very long leap from felt making to paper making. And I had been weaving with linen primarily as my chosen material. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, well, why couldn't flax be in with the wool? And, you know, and that's what, you know, I ended up doing. And I ended up making something that was sort of like tapa cloth in a way, not strictly speaking made the same way, but had that heavy paper-like quality.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So paper obviously then become very much part of my interest, and I would have studied it, except that the college I was at, the only paper making facility was in the printmaking department, and they wouldn't let you in if you weren't a printmaking major.
Oh.
So bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but I stuck with making that kind of work for about 10 years, because it was wonderfully versatile. I was very interested in working fairly large scale at that point, and it was very scalable. Worked a lot with color at that point as well, because I could blend. I could dye the flax, blend the color in, you know, a very detailed way, which I kept thinking, well, I'm going to stop doing this and, you know, focus on paper, but things kept happening. I kept getting projects.
So. So what kind of projects? And were you
I'd be invited to have galleries, exhibitions. I did get some commissions. That sort of thing. And the in Ontario, where I live, there was quite a strong network of public galleries throughout the province. And they were very receptive to, this is, I'm talking about the 80s now, right, to artist projects. And there were a group of us who were kind of proactive and organized shows and, you know. Anyway, but eventually, I really wanted to make proper paper. I wanted to get inside the material rather than, you know, just rearranging it, which is, you know, what I'd been doing. Right. And it was at that point I really started to try and figure out how I could do that.
And how did you do it?
Well, as we all know, the beater, the Hollander beater, is the magic tool. And I was offered an opportunity to use one that existed at a college that had a book arts program that it had canceled, but it still had the beater. And I think by this time I might have actually gone to Carriage House in Boston and had a you know, one of the 2 week
those great programs workshops they do.
Fantastic. Yes. Oh, I can't say enough about Donna and Elaine. They were just fantastic. And after that, then I really did want to use a beater. And so I was offered this opportunity, and I so I had, you know, a good part of a summer where I could test things out, decide, was I prepared to make the investment? I mean, I had never bought a car. I'd never bought like a proper washing machine. I'd never bought anything. And so this would be my biggest investment. But it was, so I wanted a David Reyna beater. So eventually I did get that. So okay. Luck has had a lot to do with things, you know. And I think it does in life. You have opportunities come your way.
Right. So when you were using that beater, what kind of fibers were you working?
Well, of course, I was working with flax, and mind you, I had a lot of flax because I'd been using it for my other work. But I should also tell you that I had encountered Helmut Becker.
Oh yeah.
We were invited to be in a show together, and you know, so I was working very large. He was doing these large flax installations, and I was using flax as well. And so we had these great conversations, and I was also working as a magazine editor at the time, for Ontario Crafts Council's publications. Okay. And I thought, well, Helmut, he'd be a really interesting interview. So I went to his place and to interview him, which was, you know, Helmut, it was absolutely a fabulous experience. And we stayed up all night building crates for a show he was in, I think. But in the course of it, of course, he, you know, shared so much of his knowledge about growing flax, processing it.
Yeah,
telling stories about Douglas Vorsau and all his adventures. So that was really great fun and fascinating. And so I found flax a very interesting material, because it's a very understated. It's quite a sort of modest looking material, but then it can do all these incredible things. And When I had been weaving back in my student days, I had been weaving linen, but making sort of buckled tapestry surfaces. So I was very interested in not in the flatness of textiles, but in the three-dimensionality. And so I think that really attracted me as well, that, you know, there was this inner life of the fiber that could be activated, you know, as you so beautifully demonstrated in your film.
Water, paper, time.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the flax fiber. Because like what you were actually using, because now there's this sheep pulp that people can buy that's bleached and completely different than what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes, I know. I might have a piece of that somewhere, but no, I'm talking about fiber flax.
Yeah.
That, would be used for spinning. And I had this line flax that, because that's, I cut my own when I was making the sort of felted flax, and I do that with quotation marks around it because it is, strictly speaking, is not felted. But so line flax, which is the top quality really, because from that you can spin these gorgeous threads. Well, if you know how to do it well enough, you can. It's quite a challenge in itself. Yeah. So I would be cutting that to about sort of inch lengths. But then, of course, I was able to get from Carriage House this lovely, also quite high quality, very little shive in it, but cut to about a quarter inch. This will save my hands. That's what I started using. And that is still what I would use. I was using it just, you know, as it came. But then I also have cooked it a bit if I want to lighten it. I mean, there's a lot of extra junk in there that it is a kind of interesting junk, but a lot of people use washers to get that out because I don't have a washer and it's not really worth. But what I often will do is beat it halfway, drain the whole thing, put in new water, start over again. I just clean it that way. It's a lot of work, but you know, it's good exercise. So all those buckets. But if you cook it gently, you know, and just a bit, you also clean it and it doesn't lose all of the character, but it just lightens it a bit. So I did that. Yeah, with one whole body of work, and that was quite nice, really nice creamy color. Does the sheep pulp do all the good things as well? Does it?
No, it's really different. You know, I haven't worked with flax a lot myself, raw flax, so I can't really speak to it. I just got sucked into Abaca and never have deviated. But I do a lot of watermarking, and this flax sheep pulp is good for that. And it does become translucent, but it's white. It looks more like abaca. It's even whiter. It's bleached really white.
Yeah. No, I should try that. But anyway, I use abaca a lot as well. It's wonderful.
Right. Right.
Wonderful fiber. And it does have, it is a little easier to handle. Unless you're working right from the raw fiber, which, you know,
yeah, I don't do that. Yeah.
It's all of it.
Right, right. So tell me about your studio. So when you got that Raina beater, is that the same studio you have?
Yes. And in fact, it all kind of coincided with a group of us bought a building.
Okay.
I mean, that encapsulates rather a lot of time and effort to just say that.
Yeah.
12 of us, you know, Toronto went through a big crunch or sort of bubble, like I think it was happening elsewhere as well, at the end of the 80s. And, you know, real estate prices kept going up and up. We were all in various buildings that were, you know, going to be prime for redevelopment. And, you know, artists were, you know, getting pushed out of the city. And I had put in miles of copper piping into my studio building so I could have water. And I didn't, you know, I didn't own it. And I'm not doing this again for somebody else. And so a group of us who all felt the same way, we started looking at old industrial buildings that, anyway, it took us a long time, but we did. And only because the market then crashed and we were able to, you know, the prices came down. We bought an old mattress factory. And so it's a three-story brick building. And of course, then we had to convert it to our uses. And there was a year's sort of renovation and blah, blah, blah. And so that's where I have my studio. So I'm on the top floor, which is perhaps not ideal. Paper maker, but as lovely wood, hardwood floors. So I don't have, I actually did put in a floor drain. I thought that might be good for emergencies, but I don't have a proper wet floor. I've covered the floor with rubber.
Like a paint on?
No,
actually, a rubber mat.
Yeah. Okay. The kind of thing that people, you know, it comes in, 3 foot wide, and it's got little gritty marks. It's, you know, we have winter here, so people use these for wanted areas right. that you need to protect. And it just, you know, keeps the, you know, the worst. And so I can't make paper as a real production person would, because you can't do that without getting water all over the place, really.
Right.
No. I've changed, you know, because I've changed what I do quite drastically from time to time, I kind of kept my options open to, so a lot of my equipment is on locking casters, so it can be moved. Mm-hmm. I only have 800 square feet, which is never enough.
Yeah.
But I do other stuff, you know. I studied bookbinding, and so I'm doing dry stuff, sometimes I'm doing wet stuff. So so I have a beater. I have my lovely beater. I have a small press, just the 20-ton aardvark
press. Okay.
And but I also have a very ancient Chuck Hilger system, the early vacuum table system.
Oh.
Did you know that one? I got it from Catherine Lipke years and years ago. Okay. And where it, you know, you have the tank and the compressor, and it's just a copper tube that goes in under a plastic layer that's on top of your work, on top of a waterproof surface. So your work is just on the surface, but the you know, you create a water seal with the plastic, and that's your vacuum. So I use that to press larger pieces.
Okay. What size is that?
Yeah, the table's about 4 feet by 7 feet, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. This is a great way to suck water out and apply pressure rather than having the hydraulic press. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I build the image. So
for dimensional
so this table,
work.
I painted this table with bathroom a bathtub finish, and so then, you know, just lay some screening and some pellon depending on what's required, really, and then often I'll have pressed components a bit, depends what I'm doing actually, but you know, press components and then start assembling them on the table and then press the whole thing, because that's one of the beautiful things is that, and you know, it's true of abaca but of flax as well, that it will stick to itself really well if you get it at the right moisture content, so you can build images. And I discovered that actually it's if you can't get it all done in one day, which frequently you can't, if you just leave the vacuum in place, and when you come back the next day, it's just the way you left it. It's fantastic. So you can then start working again, and it's still the moisture content.
Right. That's interesting, this way you're talking about working. So I want to talk about some of your techniques, because you've used Well, let's just do that. I was just going to say this wet pressing, or this, what you're just talking about, Kelsey Pike, who is a younger paper maker and just wrote this book called Modern Papermaking. One of the techniques in her book is that making sheets, and she did it because she didn't want to have to set up different vats of different colors. So she would just make all of small sheets in one color, press them, small sheets in another color. Well, probably press them all at once. And then she would collage those sheets onto another base sheet. So it's just interesting how, different people use similar techniques for different purposes. I love it.
Well, I guess, and probably everyone in the world who works with this material has figured this out, but so I did a whole series of pieces that are based on text. So I'm writing with the pulp. So I'm writing
Yes.
words and then pressing them now, and writing them and writing them and writing them, because you have to build up a certain, or I did anyway, a certain thickness. And
Yeah.
then those would be pressed to a certain point, and that's important to
Well, wait,
gauge.
let's go back one
Oh,
step. So, how are you squirting? So, you're squirting.
the
And
old
what
school.
pulp?
So flax or abaca, and colored. I was working with color at this point, and formation age in, and you sort of have to just get
The right
the
consistency.
moisture content about you. And then writing, I'd
And
have
so
a
you're putting it in like a ketchup
squeeze
bottle,
bottle. Yeah.
juice bottle.
And I have a lot of them, and I have those nozzles cut at different levels, so sometimes it's a thicker line and sometimes thinner. And so then I it was like typesetting. So I have these sheets of marked out Pellon sheets with the size of text that I'm working with. And so I do this. And of course, it all has to be really big because it's going to shrink. Because as we know, the flax or the abaca will shrink. It was shrinking like 30 to 40% sometimes, because the thicker you make it, the more it shrinks. So anyway, so then I would treat these sheets as a kind of lines of text. So I'd press those and then transfer them to my work table, where I start constructing the form, overlapping them where I wanted them to connect up, and pressing them with the vacuum dough, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can let that dry. But then I started making layers of them and wanting to extend them as well. And what I found worked really well was I could sort of make masking tape with the I would just make lines of the same color, and I could just attach them. And once it dried, you had to get the right color with each section. It wouldn't show at all, and it made this permanent bond. It just all fused together. It worked like a dream, but you really did have to keep track. You had to have a bottle sort of numbered with each color. So anyway, fun and games, but it really works.
What was this? You have your work is all on your website. What's the title of those pieces?
Oh, okay. So there's a couple of series
Oh,
of
I see.
those.
Revision is one.
Yes, revisions is one. Okay, the first series.
Oh, it doesn't matter. I see
So the first series was
Verso.
called Verso. Then there
Okay.
was revisions. Anyway.
Yeah. We'll put a photo of one of those on the in the show notes. Great.
So flax masking tape, I recommend it.
Flax masking tape. I love that. And what about displaying those pieces? Were they framed or
Oh boy. Well, they don't have to be. It sort of depends. There's one very large piece. It's on the website. It's called A Gathering, and I showed that just on large pins, like long pins. I like doing that, just suspended, and then you get the shadows. But, you know, once you start dealing with galleries, they sort of freak out. And so I have framed those smaller ones. And of course, the framer doesn't want to have anything to do with actually mounting them. So I sew them.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sew them. And I've used to get a separation. I sometimes put a glass bead in behind.
Okay. Yeah.
Just so they float a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, fiddle, but.
Yeah. Right. Right. Oh, but, interesting. Yeah. Talk a little bit about another technique or how, and you've already mentioned that you wanted to get into the fiber. That was your whole reason for paper making. So I'm intrigued by this and how, you know, you've done a lot of different techniques. Do you feel like you're experimenting while you're making a series of work, or are you wanting to make a series and you're choosing the technique? Just a little kind of how that.
Yeah, well, it always takes me a very long time to get anywhere. So I think fundamentally, it's important to me for the way the thing is made and the kind of concept behind it to be unified. It just, you know, it's for me to feel right about it, that you know, that has to be there. And I do find that, you know, like each body of work kind of leads to the next one in the sense that you start thinking about things. I mean, that's the great thing about being in the studio, and I'm by myself in the studio, which is great because I don't talk to anybody. I talk to myself. And so then, you know, an idea will suggest itself, but then often I have to investigate a lot of things. And the idea can come, you know, I'll give you an example, the text-based pieces that we were talking about. I can't remember if there was a precursor to this. Well, you know, I've been very involved with books. I studied bookbinding, and so I'm, you know, that's not unusual to be thinking about that. But in 2003, when Baghdad was bombed, and the library, remember hearing the story about the library was looted.
Right.
And I mean, the bombing itself was horrible, but the looting, the library, I thought, well, this is what happens to knowledge. This is what happens to, you know, artistic creation, to the sort of often the best things that we've done. And so I, you know, I mean, we're all familiar with the idea of shards, you know, people discovering, suddenly being able to try and understand a civilization.
Yeah.
Well, words are like that too. I mean, languages are being lost at a horrific rate. And with that goes so much of human culture and things that we probably desperately need to know. And so I started thinking about that kind of knowledge as an artifact that could be destroyed. And so what I did was I wrote a fragment from the Epic of Gilgamesh, which of course is, you know, like probably the first book that we know of. There's all kinds of stuff we probably don't know of.
That's right.
And so I wrote these words, obviously in English, because which it was not written in. but actually, cursive is quite wonderful for connecting up. It's a handy kind of tool. And so I wrote these words and let them dry. And of course, as you know from working with flax and abaca, the shrinkage can distort.
Right. Right.
And so by the time these things had dried, they were pretty hard to recognize as the words that they had been. And so then I put them together totally visually, as if I had just discovered these shards. I didn't really know what they meant until I put them all together into a shape that was, it was somewhat organic and, you know, had a kind of quasi human like form. It was taller than it was wide. And so that was kind of the beginning of how I then continued to work. That was just a one-off piece. I'd been asked to supply a piece that was something like 1 foot by 1 foot for a show. And of course this was like 3 feet by 2 feet, but they put it in anyway. So that was sort of the beginning of that. And then of course I started studying in much more depth, writing, you know, calligraphy from various, you know, Western calligraphy, Chinese, Japanese, and trying to understand what all that meant, and went on and on. And I guess in a way it still goes on, because I've stopped making it in my work, but I study Japanese calligraphy. I've been doing it for about 10 years, so it's...
Right.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about my popular Weave Through Winter online class, which takes place February 1st through 29th this year. I provide a framework for mastering paper weaving, and the paper-loving group that joins the class weaves daily and shares their work in an online classroom. Explore and invent weaving techniques, enjoy and ponder the process, discover the joy of sharing your work within our group, and see paper in new ways. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Now back to our conversation.
Text seems to be integral to a lot of your work. You also had a series, Foliate. Tell me a little bit about
that. Yes, okay. Well, Foliate, hardly surprising, followed the series that was all based on text. So this was all about the page without any text. So I guess I got, I got interested in just the idea of what a page meant in terms of, you know, how we think about knowledge and the sort of the possibilities that it suggested and, you know, and we have these expressions about, you know, the blank page and all this. Well, it was a really blank. Well, maybe if it's a piece of Japanese handmade paper, you wouldn't call that blank because there's so much going on in there. And so I just started getting sort of intrigued with the idea of kind of investing the page, these, you know, supposedly empty page, because I was working with white at this point, a lot of whiteness, trying to, because I'm interested in the experience of the viewer, you know, seeing the object and what it can do. You know, I'm kind of interested in what is that?
Yeah. So let's describe these pieces a little bit, because they are sheets of paper, but you're isolating a central section that draws the viewer in. So like a rectangle within a rectangle, using different, I think there's one with stitching, there's some restraint, just talk a little bit about.
So I went with that sort of vertical rectangle, classic page, you know, so it's because I have worked in the past with the format of the folio where you've got two pages. That was a whole other series, but and so within, yeah, so what I did was I just actually restrained a rectangular section, which in the central portion, and then so it's all the same page. I mean, it's all the same paper. Mm-hmm. It's just that one section has been made very flat. And the rest has been allowed to kind of express itself according to, you know, how I had, set it up. So it's a simple idea. But, I think Well, a lot of people have been interested in whiteness or blackness for that matter, but I kind of found whiteness more interesting because it wasn't really purely white. There were lots of little additions and playing with the different pulps against each other, which I'm sure lots of people have done. High shrinkage, that series was abaca, I'm thinking, and cotton. So using cotton and there is some black pigmented fiber as well in there.
Right. Yeah, I did notice that, and you mentioned this earlier, that you actually went back to school to learn about color.
Yeah.
So you were, a lot of your really early work was quite colorful. And did you just become interested in just the pure fiber?
Well,
you feel like you
I mean,
up color, or is there another reason? Yeah.
No, I'm actually working with color again now.
Okay, good.
No, it's, I think, no, I love color. And but I also love the absence of color. But I think color, I mean, I think it's tricky. You can't really do both at the same time, or if you do, you have to be quite careful because you could just undercut everything that you're, I think the work that doesn't have color other than the material color obviously relies much more on the texture, the shadow patterns, and that sort of thing. Color, I think, has its own power. I think it can project, it elicits emotion for sure.
Right. Right.
People. And I almost feel like it has a heat, a temperature that you can feel, depending on how you use it. And one of the things that I actually enjoyed about working with the felted flax was that I would dye different colors and then blend, but you would never lose the original color. So it would always be an optical mix.
Right.
So when you work with color in pulp, my inclination is to actually mix pulps rather than to try and make a color that is a blend. I kind of, yeah, I would say I've used it in a fairly restrained fashion. I mean, there are some quite colorful text pieces where I've used color to sort of relate to the form that I'm making. So it just depends what it is I'm making.
Well, talk a little bit about so I know you've worked with galleries and show quite a bit. Yeah, tell me a little about that.
I'd say I'd step back from that a bit of late for a number of reasons, but right out of art school, there were a group of us who were going to conquer the world with large scale fiber works. And so we put together an exhibition and managed to organize a tour of about 8 galleries. And that was a really interesting experience because, of course, we had to crate everything. We had to, we had to create a book as to how all these things were to be installed because they were all quite big. We were making them big on purpose to kind of make a point at the time because, textiles and fiber weren't really taken very seriously.
Right.
No, it has really changed quite a bit. It's quite amazing, actually. So that was kind of a great experience. It was an enormous amount of work. One of the outcomes was that we knew all these curators in these galleries, which was great. So unfortunately, I'm all retired now. It was really a wonderful way to kind of insert oneself into the into the art world in a very sort of positive way, and I continued to sometimes be invited to participate in shows, or meanwhile I was showing as well in my the gallery that was representing me. But I was also working all that time as well as an editor. So it was busy days. Right. And teaching workshops. I taught a lot of felt making workshops. And then subsequently paper making workshops, actually. Travel around with my press in the back of the car. So you've done that. Not so much fun, is it, taking all that stuff?
I don't do that anymore.
No, I don't.
Just a couple of years and that was enough. Yeah.
It's hard work.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. So did you always, when did the editing work and that kind of work, was there a
I left that job. About the time I got my beater. I figured I'd done that. That job.
Right.
And so there was that. I was also very involved in, and this was not a money-making job, unfortunately, but helping establish a contemporary program at the Textile Museum of Canada, which was a very small museum that moved into a larger space. And so a group of artists were invited to, on a volunteer basis, because they had no money, they had no staff or anything, to program for this. So I did, you know, I was involved in that for about 10 years. And yeah. 10 years seems to be my cutoff.
Yeah.
And, so that was, I mean, that was good. So I, you know, applying for grants for that and writing catalog essays. And yeah, it was great. That was, I mean, it was very interesting. So, you know, a lot of work, but so I left that job and then was, as I said, teaching a lot of workshops and then started teaching at Sheridan College School of Craft and Design. Again, I was there for about 10 years. Okay. And and they still had that beater, that Hollander beater that I had initially had a chance to use. It's an old Valley beater. And we dug it out of storage and, you know, I had to write away to get the information on how to get it fixed. And so I was co-heading the textile studio for a while. And so I tried to insert papermaking in there. But it was great. It was nice to see the old beater again. They're amazing, those Valley beaters. They just do not, you know, give up. You have to just replace.
Yeah, some artists say they're the best.
Yeah. I liked it. It rolled along. And so I was there for a long time. I enjoyed the teaching and then decided that was time enough to leave. But the editing, actually, my great it all came together when my friend Hiroko Karuno, who's a shifu weaver, decided she wanted to write a book about how you make paper thread. And she'd been working on it for a couple of years, unbeknownst to me. I didn't know she was working on that. And she approached me and asked if I would help her, you know, kind of get it finished. And so it took us another couple of, about 2.5 years, I think, to get it really finished. But it was complicated by the fact that the designer, who was already involved before I came along, was in Kyoto and didn't speak English. And we were in Toronto. None of us were, well, the designer might have been, but Hiroko and I were not conversant with digital editing software, and it was already in galleys. It was really quite an adventure, and it's a beautiful book. So it's Kigami and Kami Ito. So Kigami is a paper, is like pure paper, and Kami Ito is paper thread. And the book is really a how-to. Hiroko was very anxious to pass on what she's learned. She spent years learning because it's a practice that's, you know, there are a few people in Japan doing it, but not many. And she wanted the information to be documented.
Passed down and documented. Yeah. And it's so interesting that you, so we'll put this in the recommendations. And Julie McLaughlin, who I just interviewed, recommended it as well.
It's a beautiful book. And well, for me, it was great because, my textile background, I understood. I mean, I know how to spin. And she has a whole section on papermaking at Kadoide. Did you go to Kadoide when you were in Japan? In Niigata Prefecture, it's Kobayashi-san. Very good papermaker. Hiroko's known him for years. But because she explains at some length how paper is made, because you cannot make good paper thread without this high quality paper. Yeah. So it's got a lot in it, but it's very clear instructions, how to do this. And, she's also a very knowledgeable natural dyer, but her own work is just splendid because she's one of the few people who makes Morojifu, which is both in the warp and in the weft. It's paper thread. It's very difficult to do that. A lot of people use silk in the warp.
Right.
To make a strong warp is hard.
And she's in Toronto?
She lives here most of the time. She's in Japan, but she goes back and forth.
Back and forth.
She was in Japan for a number of years, teaching at the Kawashima Textile School.
Okay.
And and studying, and actually, she was meeting everybody.
Okay. Let's just talk about your other recommendations, and then I want to ask one other question. So you recommended White by Kenya Hara?
Yes, it's a lovely little book. And I'm sorry, I don't have it. Hold it up to the screen. It's at my studio. But Kenya Hara is a very well-known Japanese designer. I don't know if he still is, but he wasn't the founding designer at Muji, but he did become the head designer at Muji. I don't know if he still is in that role. But he wrote this little book, White. And it's just, I discovered it purely by accident, as things happen. And it had this whole meditation on whiteness. It talks about paper in that context. And it's just a lovely thing. I think it is available on Amazon. It might be a little pricey, I'm not sure. It's really lovely if you're interested in that sort of thing. I mean, the whole thing of Japanese traditional color is fascinating. So this makes a nice sort of companion to it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And then also The Solid Form of Language by Robert Bringhurst. And I'm pretty sure it was him that he spoke at the Codex Symposium a couple years ago when
probably.
I was there. Yeah.
He's a very well-known typographer and designer.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Oh, I mean, he's just amazing. But this was total fluke that I found this book. And it's a little book. Because I think it was an essay, and maybe it exists somewhere else in some other publication, but Gaspereau Press, which is a very fine printer and publisher in Nova Scotia, made this exquisite little book. And it's just his talking about language, and I guess I came upon it just as I was making these things, and it's a solid form of language.
Right.
But, he just talks about different, the shape of different words and in different languages, different alphabets. Mm-hmm. A beautifully produced little book as well. It's kind of inspiring. Anybody's books.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. Don't you feel like this serendipity? Like you're working on this and then you find this book and you might have passed by the book at another time in your life and wouldn't even have noticed it. But
That's right.
I love that. Tell me a little bit about the most recent work on your website is called Practice, and it's a beautiful collection of pieces.
Well, as we all know, COVID was weird. That was, I made that during that period. And I think it was probably influenced by a couple of things, but what I was really, thinking about was how, in that weird kind of room with no walls that we were all in, where you really didn't know what
Right.
the future was going to be. You weren't sure even what was happening at the time.
Right.
And it was sort of an attempt to focus on a daily, what it means to actually have a daily practice or some kind of, I kind of saw it as a calendar. I mean, it looked a little bit like a calendar to me. And then I had a horrible thought that a little bit like a Zoom screen with a whole lot of people in a Zoom screen. Oh, no, not that. But I had also been studying, my Shodo teacher, who is Noriko Maeda sensei, she lives in Ontario. She's an incredible calligrapher. She's on Instagram, by the way, if anybody wants
Oh,
to.
Great.
Noriko Maeda. We had been studying hiragana and using the Iroha, which is a poem, and it's the traditional way that the hiragana syllabary used to be organized. There's a different way of organizing it now, but that was the traditional way. It was a poem that used each of the hiragana syllables once, just used it once. And so it's often, presented in a sort of in lines in, mm-hmm. in a, so I had I was very much involved with that feeling of repetition of and the poem itself, the Iroha, is really about kind of a seeking for a kind of spiritual renewal, over the next sort of mountain. So they were all kind of, floating around in my head, but basically I was just really loving being in the studio.
So visually it's these circular pieces.
Yeah.
And you've done something different in each one.
Right.
So, I just counted, it's 30. I do a daily practice technique with 30 days. So this is interesting. Yeah.
Oh, is that right? Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I kind of felt I could have gone on and on, but it seemed like a good number. Yeah. So essentially there's one piece that is the pure
circle.
So it's nothing. It's just a restraint dried, and that's the actual size of the circular piece. So it's the, the kind of the, and it kind of has a moonish sort of look, just because it's translucent. And so, and then each of the others has all had a slightly different experience.
And they look really wonderful all together.
Thank you.
We'll put a picture of that. And I noticed in the caption that you used hemp fiber. So tell me a little bit about working with hemp compared to the abacan flax.
Well, you know what? I have not. The hemp was not beaten. It was an addition.
Oh, okay.
An addition. Helmut Becker sent me in the mail one day a bale of hemp.
Oh my God.
Helmut has been very involved with a research station that's been raising hemp,
about it.
And trying to establish a role for it as a fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so I have quite a lot of hemp. It's a very interesting fiber, and one of these days I will I'll actually beat it, but I haven't done so yet. But it is a nice fiber to add.
Yeah, you might need to cook it.
I'll have to cook it.
I had a student used it, and I just remember we put it in the beater raw, and we were both like, it was catching and tangling.
No,
we spent like an hour like trying to
I'm
get
sure I have to cut it, which is always hard work.
Yeah.
And,
oh.
have to do that. Yeah.
Well, what are you working on now, Susan?
Well, I just started, so I'm not quite sure yet, but it's I have a the studio is full of color. I've got buckets of let me see, what have I got? There's 3 hour abaca, and then there's like 1 hour. I've got, yeah, so I've got different. I'm building up the sort of the repertoire there.
Okay.
So what I am interested in working with color. I'm not with these, so I'm kind of I'm thinking in terms of layers. So I'm kind of interested in the layered aspect of paper. You know, the way Japanese paper when it's made is like a lamination,
right? Several dips in the back.
Yeah, many of layers. And so I was so I'd like to kind of examine building imagery that way, and color, you know, might be a good way to do that. So as you can see, it's early days.
Yeah. Are you using pigment? What are you coloring with?
Yeah, you know what? I've always used, I mean, I was a dyer, you know, trained as a dyer, but I was convinced by Elaine, and so I use the pigments. Sorry,
the aqueous dispersed
pigments that Keratose supplies, and you know, I mean, it's partly because the work that I do is usually displayed, and so light fastness is
right important
is kind of an important issue. The other thing I do like about it is if you get the formula right, takes a bit of practice, you don't actually pour stuff down the drain. It all goes into the finder.
Yeah.
And
the retention aid. Yeah, that's right.
And that with dyes, you know, very often you're rinsing and rinsing and rinsing, and I do worry about, I'm always quite careful to neutralize things that, you know, have to go down the drain with, you know, vinegar or something. But I kind of prefer the idea that really nothing much does go down.
Right. Yeah.
So I like them. I mean, they're not, you know, you do lose some qualities of the fiber. You have to be a bit careful, but I do love the overbeaten flax, if you can call it overbeaten, but you know, flax and abaca is beaten for a long time. The way it takes color is really beautiful. It's so
right,
beautiful.
Right, right. Yeah, more little receptors for pigment. Yeah. What's your when you're talking about that beating it for a long time? How many hours?
Well, you know, I have all these notes, as I'm sure you do as well. And I have done it. I'm always interested in how other people approach it, because it, you know, there's so many variables, and I wouldn't say that I've found any, you know, because, you know, do you go down quickly, or do you go down slowly? Kind of fascinating. I mean, I've done 8 hours. I'm not sure you really have to go that long. And I have done that. I mean, sometimes what I'll do is I run the beater, and then I turn it off, and I come back the next day and I run it some more. Do that?
I do that. I'll make a little test sheet at the end of the one day, and then come back and see, is it translucent enough? And if it's not, I'll beat longer. But it's so refreshing to hear you talk this way, because I just had an intern last week, and like, you start talking about this stuff and it's like, there's no right answer. There's no, like, every beater's different. Every pulp is different. It's so hard to boil it down into a nutshell. I find I'm beating my abaca now for 3 hours really hard. And that yields a translucent sheet. But there's still this, I've never talked with anyone about this this whitish look, a hemicellulose or whatever it is in the sheet. Like, I think you have to really beat it 8 hours to get rid of that. I can see my fingers right behind my sheet, but
Yeah.
if you really look at it, there's something in there. It's not pristinely translucent. Yeah.
Well, I think they get really, really tiny little fragments, and
Right.
there's enough to kind of break up the light a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, this is why I keep doing it. It's endlessly fascinating.
Right. Exactly.
I just say one other thing about
Yeah.
color, that I Donna's article in A Gathering of Papermakers, that's another
Yes.
book that I
That's a
think is
great
really,
resource.
yeah, it's really fantastic, articles in it. I mean, the Winifred Lutz article is fantastic,
Well,
of course.
that goes into the beading we're just talking about. Yeah.
But Donna's article on using coagulant and color is so much fun. I mean, I haven't, I use it sparingly, but it's, I don't know how many people actually do it. I know they do it at Carriage House, but it really is fun to, you know, you kind of create little clumps of fiber and then you can coat them with color. And I've done that. I used that in the foliate pieces. I was just doing it with black, but it was a way of getting, I didn't want just a flat color. I wanted little, you know, texture. And that was how I did it. But anyway, it's all about, she explains how to do it in that article. It's, you know, you're using regularly with a, if on a, fiber that's had retention agent in it, it causes it to coagulate into little clumps.
Right. And you can mix, you're saying you just use the black, but you could mix like blue pulp and red
Yeah.
pulp, and the little clumps will stay separate.
That's
I
right.
remember Rick Hungerford made sheets
Yeah.
out of these. You know, they were just these really interesting
Yeah, they're really funny. They look,
colored
depending
sheets.
how big they are, you can break up the clumps. Sometimes they look like little tadpoles swimming around. Sometimes they're.
Maybe we'll inspire someone because we talked about it. I just have a hunch that nobody teaches it, so nobody knows about it.
It's a bit fiddly, you know.
Yeah,
But
right. And there's
that's what
that.
we do, right? We
That's what
fiddle.
we do. Yeah. I'm going to put that Gathering of Papermakers
I do that.
as a recommendation. And I hope they're still producing that because Carriage House, I think, self-published that.
It's on their website. I
Okay,
checked.
good. So they continue to keep that in stock.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
that is.
Yeah, I was afraid it was gone, but it's a tremendous. Yeah.
That was before I even was involved in the scene, maybe the early 80s. It was literally a gathering of papermakers, and all of these articles were written about talks that people gave. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, that's really good.
Well,
And you know, and I have to say that they have been phenomenal. I mean, others have as well, but and you, Helen, you know, the amount of information that, you know, is provided for the rest of us is fantastic. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. This has been really fun.
Really nice to see you.
Yeah.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season for making paper.